Continuing with Alex Smith on 21st June, 76. And you were talking about now that the periodicity actually seems to be what?
Seems to be 11 or 12 years. And, you know, as nearly as one can determine, the peaks are not terribly sharp, but as nearly as one can determine, it seems to be a periodicity of something like 11 or 12 years. And so you say not only aha, but aha, aha. Because that matches two possible periods. It could be the orbital period of Jupiter, or it could be the sunspot period. Of course, as you know, many times in astronomical history, people have pointed the finger at Jupiter and said, well, obviously Jupiter causes sunspots because the sunspot period is the same as the orbital period, you know, to a round number of Jupiter.
And the phase is the same as the solar?
No, it's anti.
It's anti-phase.
At solar maximum, you get a minimum of Jupiter noise, and at solar minimum, of course, we're headed toward minimum now, and the Jupiter noise is peaking up again. So it's an anti-correlation. And one thing that has always intrigued me is the fact that the Jupiter curve is very close to looking like the cosmic ray curve, which has the same kind of inverse. This is the galactic component.
The modulation on extra galactic cosmic rays.
The Jupiter curve, the long-term Jupiter curve, is not at all dissimilar to the long-term cosmic ray, non-solar cosmic ray curve. But in any event, you know, this is one of the problems. Is it correlated with the sunspot cycle, or which was everybody's first guess, ours and everybody else's first guess? But Tom Carr, I think, has shown he's been very interested in this effect. And I think he has shown more and more and more convincingly, to the point where I guess if I were a gambling man, I'd say it's now 75% certain in my mind that the correlation is really with the orbital motion of Jupiter rather than with the sunspot cycle.
But it's taken, this was not established in the early 60s, of course. It's taken another
because
15
it takes, years. Well, as close as the periods are, it takes quite a while, you see, before the phase starts getting separated well enough so that you can say anything with certainty.
Okay, there's one other thing that you haven't mentioned, and that was an article in Nature in 60 in which you had two arrays 7,000 kilometers apart.
Yeah.
And what was that?
Well, it turns out, I guess historically, that we were the first group to successfully operate a VLBI. And again, this was Tom Carr. This was his idea. And we set up a VLBI to try to resolve the Jupiter sources between the radio observatory, which at that time was still, this was at that time the one on the fringe of the campus on the Agricultural Experiment Station.
This Gainesville?
Gainesville, still in Gainesville.
Yeah.
Between the Gainesville station and set of antennas that we put up on the campus of Central Florida Junior College in Ocala, which is about 30 miles to the south. And the initial idea was to use a telephone line to combine the signals. Well, we had so damn much trouble with the telephone line, it never did really work, that Tom Carr said, well, shoot, let's just do away with the telephone line and independently record the signals on a tape recorder with time hacks from WWV and recombine the signals. This worked.
Yeah. Now, when was this?
This would have been 64, I guess.
Okay, so this is after this one that I'm referring to in the 1960 Nature article. This was the 7,000 kilometer baseline that you had.
Well, that would have had to have been...
This was Smith Carr.
That would simply have been efforts to correlate the morphology of the bursts.
At
the two stations separated, it's about 7,050 kilometers from the Gainesville station to the Chile station. And we were simply studying burst morphology and seeing if we could correlate individual bursts over that distance.
Okay. But back to the VLBI, this is interesting. So about 64.
Yeah.
And
which was about a year before the microwave groups. We were able to do the thing with our relatively crude equipment because we were looking at such a powerful source, you see.
Very interesting, yeah.
And it was about a year before the microwave groups got there.
Where did you publish this?
it was the first mention of this was published in a rather obscure and unusual source. I think it was NERM.
NERM.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that. Northeast Regional Electronics Meeting.
Right. And they presented a paper on it at that mm-hmm. meeting, and the you know, it was published, I think, in the extended abstract of it was published. And then of course, in 59, we had set up, well, the upshot of this was that we were nowhere alike resolving the source with this 30-mile baseline from Gainesville to Ocala. It was clear that the source was totally unresolved. So the next thing we did was to put a station in St. Petersburg, because by that time, one of our graduate students, one of our doctoral students, Will Block, had gotten a PhD in our decametric program, was on the faculty at Florida Presbyterian, which has now been bought out as Eckerd College, and after the Eckerd drugstores.
Oh, I see.
And anyhow, Will Block was at Florida Presbyterian, now Eckerd, and so he put up a terminus, VLBI terminus there, which gave us a baseline of about 150 miles. And we operated that for a couple of seasons. Again, it was very clear that the sources were not being resolved. And so then, I guess the next step was we put one in Bowling Green, Kentucky, because by that time, Frank Six had graduated from our program mm-hmm. with his PhD and was chairman of the department at Bowling Green. Mm-hmm. And I think this is about 800 miles. And again, no evidence of resolution in the sources operating this baseline for a couple of years. Well, in 1959, we put up the Chile station. We had put up the Chile station. It was sitting down there all the time. So then finally, we made the big leap, you see, and right. put a VLBI terminus at the Chile station. And most of our operating since that time has been either from Bowling Green to Chile or from Florida to Chile. We get about 500,000 wavelengths from Bowling Green to Chile, and about a little over 400,000 wavelengths from Florida.
And are any of them being resolved?
No.
Still not.
We've got 1/10 of a second arc resolution with the Bowling Green Chile yeah. baseline, and no evidence of resolution.
Now Radhakrishnan and Morris in the early 60s at Caltech were looking at Jupiter bursts in the decimetric.
Not bursts.
Well, not bursts. I guess that's right. It was just the normal radiation.
They were looking at the microwave radiation, yeah. but that's not bursting.
Right, and they were establishing, however, that Jupiter. That's right. They made
decimetric source is like three times the size of the planet.
Right.
You know, in other words, they were seeing Frank Drake's radiation belts.
Right, and that it was tilted also.
10 degrees to the rotational axis.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So what you were doing was unconnected with this, even though that was high-resolution work, angular resolution
right.
work.
Yeah, we were looking at a totally different phenomenon.
Right.
And, well, this is one of the interesting contrasts that we've pointed out a number of times in print. The fact that the decimetric source is humongous, like
yeah.
three times the size of the planet itself, whereas the decimetric source cannot be resolved even with a baseline which gives you 10 arc second resolution.
Yeah.
And we've got some high time resolution data, which, if you interpret it in the usual way, the way that people argue about the sizes of the quasar, mm-hmm. apparently it's been investigated with all the relativistic corrections and everything else, and is honest to gosh legitimate, the light travel time argument, we have structure in the bursts. Rises or falls, front ends or tail ends of pulses, of the order of 10 microseconds.
Hmm.
And of course, this puts an even smaller limitation on the active region than the long baseline interferometry does.
Just for comparison, what would terrestrial lightning be in terms of its time changes?
It's a lot much slower than that. I couldn't really quote you a number on that, I don't have one in my head. But it's much slower than that.
Hmm.
These are the S bursts, you see.
Yeah. Well, 10 microseconds, that's what, 3 meters?
No.
Right.
No. It's more than that. I would have
It's 3,000 meters, 3 kilometers.
3 kilometers, yes. Right.
Okay, was there anything else We've covered everything, I think, in the late 50s. Was there anything else in the up till 63 or so that you
wanted to mention? One thing that might be interesting from a historical point of view is the Chile station.
Mm-hmm.
At the time it went into operation, unless our information is incorrect and nobody's ever challenged this, is that we believe it was the first active radio astronomical observatory on the continent of South America.
I see.
To go into operation on the continent of South America.
And that was when, 59 or something
like
that?
Well, we built it in the summer of 59 and put it into operation in the spring of 60. That was the first apparition of Jupiter after the observatory.
Where in Chile is it?
It's at near the historic town of Maipú. It's historic because the final battle for the liberation of Chile was fought at Maipú.
Mm-hmm.
Monuments there, you know, generals on horseback, so, and Bernardo O'Higgins. And it's like our station at the University of Florida was. It's on University of Chile farmland on their agricultural experiment station. It's about 18 miles from Santiago.
I see. So how would you summarize the contribution that your group has made to the Jovian decametric game up until the early 60s in particular?
Well, I would say our work, some of the important things was our work on rotation periods, the system three and the mm-hmm. refinement of the rotation period, and the demonstration at about, just again, this is one of those things that was virtually simultaneous, just about the same time the Yale people became aware of it, that the doggone rotation period was changing,
mm-hmm.
which was rather startling. And this became evident in the early 60s. The demonstration by simultaneous observations from both hemispheres that the polarization phenomena that were being observed were not terrestrial in origin. This was, I think, one of the early big inputs from the Chilean station.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you'd have reversed polarization phenomena if they were terrestrial in origin.
Yeah.
And we observed the same polarization phenomena from both stations, indicating that they were not terrestrial in origin. I guess we've done a lot of work on the burst morphology, the demonstration of the existence of the two classes of bursts, the L bursts and the S bursts, the first successful long baseline interferometry of Jupiter, or of anything for that matter.
Okay, well, that's a long enough list. What other groups were there working on Jupiter in the late 50s besides the ones that have been mentioned already? In the whole world, I mean.
Yale was, I guess, the chief competitor. And a little later, Jim Warwick at Colorado with Dulk as a graduate student, mm-hmm. later faculty member, got into the game in a very complementary rather than competitive way by doing this beautiful wide-range spectroscopy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very valuable.
Yeah. And you've always stuck to one frequency band, pretty much.
We're doing a great deal of spectrographic work now, but again, it's not competitive with the sort of thing that Jim Warwick has been doing, because what we're doing now is very, instead of the broad stuff, we're doing very high resolution in both time and wavelength type, where we record the stuff on videotape and later massage it.
Yeah.
You know, one of those things where you take 10 minutes of data and a graduate student spends 3 years analyzing 10 minutes of data.
Were there any other groups?
Barrow, when he left us, went to Florida State. Now, I don't remember exactly when he got into business, but he set up a Jupiter monitoring operation at Florida State. It wouldn't have been much later than the early 60s, probably sometime certainly in the early 60s. What year, I don't know.
There's nothing in Australia or in Europe?
Well, Shane continued to do some Jupiter observing. I always had the impression he never did it terribly intensively, but he continued doing some Jupiter observing. As a matter of fact, Tommy Carr went over to Australia again, right around the early 60s, 60, 61, sometime there, and spent some months over there with the Australians, mm-hmm. and sort of, I guess, in a way, kind of got them stirred up again, so that for a little while they did do a fair amount of Jupiter observing. It didn't seem again to last terribly long. And the long-standing programs, there were a number of people, because it's basically a sort of simple kind of observation to make, a number of people who dove in and dove out, you know,
right.
they put up an antenna and listen for a year and maybe publish a note someplace, and then you never heard any more about it. But the long-standing programs were our program, the Yale program, until really it more or less bodily moved to Texas, and Jim Douglas still doing it, and the Colorado.
When did that happen? When did he go to Texas?
When he went to Texas, that must have been something like 65.
Okay, just roughly. Mm-hmm. So those three American programs, the Russians weren't doing anything along this line?
Surprisingly not, because Browda, you know, has mm-hmm. had this humongous low-frequency enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for some reason, I get a Christmas card from him every Christmas.
He must like yours.
But in any event, no, they never seem to have done any appreciable amount. Now, Rihima in Finland did some strictly spectroscopic work, very nice spectroscopic work, high speed, mm-hmm. again, high speed, high resolution spectroscopic work. And then he came over and did a couple of years of sabbatical with us.
When was this now?
Oh, again, middle 60s.
I see, so this is still later.
Yeah, and Len went and spent a couple of years with Jim Warwick at Colorado before going back to Finland.
So, starting with Burke and Franklin, this was pretty much exclusively an American, except for Shane's.
Yeah, for some sporadic activity,
yeah.
except for some sporadic activity in Australia.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty much... Well, now, Ellis and McCulloch in, of all places, Tasmania, did some very low frequency stuff. And that, I guess, would have started in the early 60s.
Where was that published?
Mostly, I think, in the Australian Journal of Physics.
Well, yeah, that's a logical place. Well, any other comments that you think of in the overall statement? I think we've been pretty thorough here.
Well, nothing comes to my mind unless you have.
No, I don't. Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. That concludes the interview with Alex Smith at Haverford College, the AES meeting on June 21st. 1976.